Winner of the Tobias Wolff Award in Fiction, Ted O'Connell is a writer and musician whose creative products have been featured in literary magazines, quite a few of them, some of the best in the country. He's also been, his work has appeared in taverns, that is, bars and music halls throughout the country, because he is a mandolin player. Did I ever tell you my grandfather played the mandolin? I think maybe that's why I feel such affection for you, Ted. He plays the mandolin with the Prozac Mountain Boys and guitar. He also writes and sings, and also with Scarlet Locomotive. He was twice a visiting professor in China. Originally from Chicago, Ted currently lives in Bellingham, Washington, with his wife and daughter. Ted, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Beautiful to be here, Daniel. I really appreciate it.
And I have to apologize because I've been recording at home for the last several months, and the very first show I recorded at home was with you, but I somehow made a really grave errors, and so we have to do this show again. So thank you for your patience and joining us again.
I'm happy to be the guinea pig. Better me, an old friend, than somebody else, right?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way of looking at it. Thank you. And so we are here to talk about your first novel, your first book, K. It's called K, like the letter K, a novel. Tell us a little bit about this book, how it came about.
Well, as you mentioned, I taught in China for 2 years, actually kind of a year and a half, and I was there for two stints. And I just have to say, when I lived in China, I couldn't stop thinking of Kafka. Every time I saw a locked door or a weird hallway or a bureaucrat that was kind of like barking at me, seemingly unnecessarily, I thought about Franz Kafka and his work all the time. And I also, in class, would sometimes be saying things that were maybe a little bit on the edge of what I was supposed to say and not supposed to say. And I started to imagine, like, what would it be like if I, you know, said the wrong thing? What if I, you know, really made a mistake? And the truth is, I probably just would have been, you know, sent back home on the first plane. But that doesn't make for a very interesting novel. So I imagine, like, what would it be like if a professor in China, you know, did get thrown in prison for, you know, reasons that seemed to us anyway unjustified?
You mean for saying the wrong things in class and encouraging perhaps a little bit of rebellion among the students?
Yeah. Yeah. And specifically, it was this quote by James Baldwin, that kind of famous quote, something like, you know, I love America more than any other country in the world. And exactly for this reason, I reserve the right to criticize her perpetually. And I thought, oh, that's a cool thing to have my students say. That's a fun little statement because I was late for class. And I wasn't prepared. And I was like, oh, I love that. You know, I love that line. I Googled it and found it. And, you know, I had the students, you know, saying this statement, which they seemed to like. And about halfway through the lesson, spontaneously, this one young lady replaced the word America with China. She said, I love China more than any other country in the world, and exactly for this reason, I reserve the right to criticize it perpetually. I was like, no,
oh,
don't say
my
that.
God.
And another student did it, and another, and I was like, this could be troublesome. I better go back to the boring lessons.
Did you get paranoid at all, like thinking you were being watched or thinking that there was somehow an observer?
One time when I tried to Google for something on the Mormon church or the LDS church for some reason for a story I was working on. And like something kind of weird happened with my internet then. It didn't show up. And then, but not really. I mean, there were class monitors in each class, which were, you know, really, really friendly, top notch, you know, amazing students who did have a responsibility to the party if something went wrong. But even this is 2010, 2012. The surveillance levels then were much lower than they are now. I mean, I think I've been talking to people who are teaching there right now, but certainly things, there's way more like cameras everywhere. Mm-hmm. The truth is I didn't feel too watched.
Well, you must have, I know this is going to sound like a weird comparison, but I can't help but compare your experience to Einstein. Whereas Einstein would imagine himself chasing after a beam of light at the speed of light. What would it be like? Would light be stationary? And he thought about this and imagined it for many, many years before he found the equation that would actually turn out to be special relativity. And I'm wondering, did you imagine this novel, the scenario, get into your character, whose name is Kaufman, K, the professor in China who gets arrested for inciting rebellion among his students. Did you Did you imagine this novel before you started writing, or did you just start writing and without going through that imagination period?
Thanks for the comparison to Einstein. I get that a lot, actually.
Yeah,
when I can't put my socks on the right way. I think to answer your question in the most honest, accurate way, it's kind of both. I have the cute little spiral, flowery notebook that I, you know, was using at the time that I started working on the novel, because I wrote everything longhand. And I loved all these cool notebooks I could get in the drugstores in China. They were just beautiful, gorgeous. They were really, really pretty, and I have a fetish for notebooks. And I was on a regular writing routine, and I know I sat down for my, you know, kind of my demanded, self-demanded free writing one day. And in the notebook where it all started, it does have kind of an idea. It starts with an idea. It's like, oh, what if I wrote a story? I used the word story. I didn't use the word novel. What if I wrote a story about a guy, a professor, who crosses a line in China and gets, you know, hauled into prison? And then there's space in the notebook, and then I wrote a first line. And that first line didn't end up being the first line of the novel, but it was a line that I used later, maybe on like page 6 or something like that. So then it was like, it was an idea kind of from the outside. And then I just went boom into the interior of like, oh, here's the guy. He's in prison. This is the first line. So from that point, then it was more imaginative, more kind of like, I don't know where this is going, you right. know, just kind of feel my way blindly.
Did you like daydream about it? Like, you know, lay on a couch or sit in a park or even lay in bed, imagining what was happening to Professor Kaufman?
Yeah, kind of. I think my process is like, I write and I wander and I daydream while I'm writing. And then this almost never fails to happen. I get up from like a long writing session, like 2 or 3 hours, and I'll be like, okay, I got time to go make some coffee. It's time to go for a walk, or, you know, take my daughter to, you know, wherever. And it often happens that as I'm getting up and leaving, I'll daydream then and go, oh crap, wait, here's another idea. And I'll go back and write down that idea. So sometimes it's like there's this weird, like, you know, tether or something to the work. Right. I'll try to get away from it and it'll pull me back.
You know, you're in Beijing, which is a completely different city from Bellingham, Washington, where you live, not only in terms of, you know, it's yeah. immense size, but just culturally and technologically and just so many things going on in Beijing that I imagine, and also not to mention the language difference. I know you acquired a lot of Chinese while you were there, but it still nonetheless... opportunity to be misunderstood, or opportunity not to be able to have to work harder to get yourself understood or to understand what others are saying. And so I imagine that pushes you deeper and deeper into self. And I'm wondering, as you went deeper into self, did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy the imagination that came with that falling deeper and deeper into away from what is in the exterior?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. The bulk of the first draft of this novel was written in a 5-week period over the Chinese New Year. My wife and daughter had gone back to the States to tend to a loved one. So I was kind of lonely because there was no, it was holiday. There was no teaching going on. They have a really long break at that time. So I was very much kind of alone in the apartment. And so there was that kind of aloneness that Eugene Kaufman experiences. So that's certainly part of the process. And yeah, I think when you're literally a foreigner in another country, I think it's good for whatever those neurons are that make you write. I think you do see the world in a different way. It's kind of like a drug, you know, in a sense that you sort of see things differently. I mean, I'm not the first person to say that traveling and being an expat, I thought I was really an expat. I was more like an extended tourist, to be honest. Right. But living in another country, I think it's good for the mind.
Absolutely. And let me ask you this. I don't know if, I think if I ask this question to a lot of people, it wouldn't make a lot of sense, but I think it makes sense to you. Were you ever like so intently writing, I mean, just completely in the zone, and then you go for one of those walks and suddenly the city is giving you creative fodder for your next writing section?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, totally. Just like you, and the thing is, I could not have written this book based solely on memory, like from retrospect. Like if I had to write about my childhood or something, you know, in summers in Wisconsin, I have enough there that I can work with it. But anything that's, if there's anything good in that book, Most of it is stuff that I wrote while I was there because I was just right, you know. I really had my antennae, you know, like there working. And yeah, I'd wander and I'd see an image and then, you know, think about it. I might tap out on my little, I didn't have a cell phone, then I had like a little iPod kind of thing. Uh-huh. I might tap notes. Yeah, a lot of wandering and dreaming.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, when we're focused on something, I think this is just how the brain works. When we're really intently focused on something, that the landscape tends to reveal things that encourage and reinforce our focus. So I imagine there were experiences that you would see something and they go, that's it. That's what I need in my novel.
Well, here's an example. Something just popped in my head. Okay, so we butcher each other's languages big time, right? So I did my best to learn as much Chinese as I could for the time. And I would get words wrong and people laugh at me. And, you know, it's a hard word to understand. And in turn, that, you know, Chinese will butcher English too. Like, so for example, you see lots of misspellings and you can Google any kind of, you know, funny Chinese sign. And you'll see all kinds of things, right?
Oh yeah. I remember one that I saw in a bar. It says in the bathroom door, it says no bowels.
Exactly. And they're funny, right? And there's one, like, I remember seeing like Winnie the Hoop, H-O-O-P, like for, you know, you see the big honey bear, like uh-huh. On a towel, Winnie the Hoop. And then I saw one guy wearing a black satin jacket that said Pally Boy, and it was with the Playboy Bunny. And I knew that I'd been writing this scene where the secret police follows Kaufman, and they're hot on his trail, and it's a little bit noir-like, you know, but I didn't want it to be like too noir-like, so I was Googling like stories, of course, with my VPN, Googling stories about the secret police in China, and I saw this picture of this guy who was an actual secret police man, member, and he was wearing this black mask and a black hat, and it just looks so typical and noir. I'm like, I can't use that, man. It's just like, that's just too cheesy. And then I was like, I got it. I'll put that guy, I'll give him a Pally Boy jacket. So it's like, yeah, you know, I remember I was in the subway, the guy with the Pally Boy jacket.
Wow, you know, that's great.
You know, you take something that's sort of trite and, you know, typical and add Pally Boy.
Walk us through the moment you started it all the way until you knew you had a publishable draft.
Gosh, okay. So a gush of creative energy, a 5-week period in 2013 in January and February. And then I, you know, went back to the States and had a job and, you know, was working full time and working on other projects. So then, you know, off and on, probably, you know, 3 years after that, I felt pretty confident that I had something good, about 2 years maybe after that. So what, 15, 16? No, more like 16, 17. But I didn't hear anything from Santa Fe Writers Project until December of 2018. So it took me a while, and there were, you know, a fair amount of rejections in there, like it is for most writers, unless your name is Cheng Wei Li.
I don't think he gets rejected anymore. Just for background, Cheng Wei Li is a fantastic fiction writer, Korean-American fiction writer from New York that we went to grad school with. Ted and I went to grad school at the University of Oregon for our MFA, and Cheng Wei was there and certainly has become one of the most successful writers in the world today.
Yeah. So that guy that you went to high school with that made it to the NBA, he's our NBA player.
So how long did it take you to write it though?
Okay. Well, I mean, so it's a hard answer. The question to answer, I guess I would say like, when did I have that thing completed? 2017, 2016, you know, so 3-4 years for me, it's, you know, I'm slow. I'm in two bands, actually three. Or was in three bands until the pandemic started. So that's, I guess, the best answer I can give. You know, a gush of creative output, like, for 5 weeks, and then a good draft after maybe a year. I'd probably let it go for about a year after that. So, you know. But all told, from day one to publication was, I think, if you do the math, it's like 7 years, which is longer than I'd like it to be, but that's just what it is.
That sounds about right, though, for a novel. I think for a literary novel, unless you're one of those writers that just, you know, pounds out pop fiction. Even if we look at Cheng Wei, I think he might come out with a book every 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so when you were ready for it, who, tell us about the point from, I'm really interested in this because, you know, I know, I've known you for a long time, and I know that you have been writing all this time before China. You were writing collections of stories, you were writing novels. So when you got it done, when you said, okay, this is a good book, tell us about the process of going from that point to getting it published. You mentioned rejections a little while ago. Maybe you can go a little bit more into that, because I think a lot of writers have a book and they're a little clueless, you know, who can blame them on what to do next.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, like most people, I tried to get an agent first, and, you know, I think you get, it's hard whether to put much stock in what agents tell you, but I think you kind of get a sense from the kind of notes you get back, you know, because a lot of the notes I got back from agents were actually really encouraging. Like, this is a fantastic novel, but, or this is like, well, you're really, really good writer. But so that for whatever it's worth, and maybe that's just, you know, my lame self-esteem, but that helps you feel a little bit like, okay, well, this is not the place in the marketplace. And then, you know, you go to AWP and you look for small presses, and, you know, I think I submitted it to two or three, small presses, kind of forgot about Santa Fe Writers Project, for a while, didn't know much about them. And it turns out they have a 20-year history of like really, really good track record and, you know, amazing list, really, really, really strong list of writers there. But I think if I were to do some numbers, I probably pitched 20 to 30 agents and probably heard nice things from like 8 of them or something like that. I decided that's, you know, just not the end all be all. I'll try some small presses. And I think I submitted to 4 of those places or something, and you know, got some good news in December of 2018, made for a nice Christmas.
And Santa Fe Writers Project, which published this book, is a fantastic press, and they clearly love this novel.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew Gifford is the publisher there, and I think he said something in his first note, like, you know, that he called it a page-turner, which is, you know, weird, because I remember going back to our Oregon days, I think one of the things I learned from you is, like, not to be afraid of plot. You know, I remember you used to walk around the campus with a John Grisham novel under your arm, being like, I'm learning plot from this guy, and I don't care if you think he's not a good writer. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. I think I was afraid of plot for a few years. I was, you know, trying to be hip, trying to be MFA, that, you know, trying to be that metafiction guy or whatever it was I was trying to be. And I was like, one day I looked at all the writing that I liked and I was like, you know, Carver's plots are pretty great.
Yeah,
Virginia
absolutely.
Woolf's plots are pretty great. I like plot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go.
Chang Ray Lee's plots are pretty amazing. You know, I think what it is to remember where plot comes in terms of the shape of the book, and I can't help but think of the equation that Ehud Hafsochet, gave us, and that is P equals CH over T, which is plot equals character over time. And I think in popular fiction like John Grisham, one of the things I learned by reading John Grisham is what a horrible writer he is. And he is a horrible writer, but he's a great plotter. He knows how to plot. However, his characters are dragged through the plot and they seem to have no will of their own because they have to submit to the plot. Whereas what Ehud taught us about literary fiction is that plot equals character over time. You put the character in a situation, and based on that character's need, that character's yearning, that's what the plot's going to end up being.
And, you know, something you said sort of prods me to circle back to your question earlier about, because I want to relate it to that, the process of publication, because I do recall that, you know, after some rejections from these agents, again, not that you let agents completely dictate how you're going to write your book, but you look at yourself, you look at the own work. I spotted what I thought was kind of a flaw in the voice. I felt like the voice in my narrator, it's a first person narration, so it's like pretty key for that voice to be authentic. I felt like the voice was off in places, that it wasn't authentic. And I don't want to get into the nitty gritty details about that, but it's just like, it's a sense of authenticity and genuineness that you get. You're like, no, it sounds false. It just doesn't ring quite true. Mm-hmm. So I think it was essentially like, I need to make this guy sound more like a guy from who grew up in Chicago in the 80s, you know, because that's closer to my bio. So I made him more like myself and less like this imagined person I had out there. And that was the key. So in other words, that's voice. It's like this element of fiction, right? But it's related in, you know, it's related to plot in the sense like what's happening to this guy. But it's, you know, like you said, plot equals character over time. And if that character isn't authentic over time, then you're screwed. You know, you're not going to, you know, do your best work. So that to me was a pretty big key. And once I got that kind of figured out, I started feeling more confident about it. So that was probably what, like 5 years after I started the thing.
Yeah. And, when, you know, the equation that Ehud gave us, plot P equals CH over T, to me, I had to add on the CH times Y, which is yearning, because I think that without character yearning, there's no story. It's not just this person's characteristics are going to lead to a plot, you know, what they're like, how they interact with other people, but their desire, it's their desire that's going to drive them. And, you know, and I know you know that, you know, character desire, character need is fundamental to fiction. And I'm wondering if you knew, if you were able to articulate or just maybe sense the need of your character, Professor Kaufman.
So that was definitely a process of discovery. I just got done teaching George Saunders' Puppy. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. And I kind of realized as I was teaching it to my students that, like, okay, there's surface level plot and then there's kind of deep level plot. The surface level plot is like this family's going to go try to buy a puppy. But the deep level plot is like the family's trying to stay safe and happy, and you know, this woman's desperate. So there's like, that's the kind of yearning. And she wants her family to be happy. She doesn't want her kids to have the life that she has. So she makes some pretty questionable parenting choices. But for me, it was like the surface level plot is, oh, this guy's in prison. How's he going to get out? Or how's he going to, you know, how's he going to negotiate or navigate this space? He's the only Westerner in a prison, in a prison cell shared by seven other men who are all Chinese. And for a moment, for about a month, he pretends not to know Chinese, though his Chinese is excellent. So he's really kind of alienated from his brothers in the prison, right? And they're not his brothers. But the need, you know, the yearning that I discovered through, you know, pages and pages of writing was that, man, this guy has trouble with intimacy. He doesn't have a really good friend. He doesn't, you know, and he doesn't really know how to love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he thinks he wants to be a great writer, but what's really ultimately more important for him is to be a storyteller surrounded by his brothers, these prisoners who become his brothers towards the end of the novel around an oil can fire. Like that's ultimately way more that yearning to be a storyteller, but not just a writer with your name in Krieg lights, but a storyteller to a community of people. That's way more powerful and way more meaningful. And he had to, you know, the character had to learn that.
Wow, that's powerful. That's powerful. So yeah. Let's change the subject a little bit here. Well, I think it's going back to the same subject. I was in China, I went to Beijing and I visited you and I hung out with you and your family for a while. And we went to the Great Wall of China and it was really a wonderful outing, a great day. But one of the things that we decided, we went to this little store, this little tiny independent store, you know, like a little shack right before you get to the wall. And it just, I guess it just evoked our imagination so much. You said, hey, you know what? Let's each write a story about the wall. And then we'll read each other's stories. I go, oh, that's a great idea. And I remember I wrote a story. I don't think I ever revised it or did anything with it. Did that story end up being at all a part of this novel?
It did not. It's a free, not that I know of. I mean, I bet you I probably saved an image or something from there. I'm trying to think if I did or not. But I called it The Store Before the Wall, and I can't remember if we both decided it had to be the same title or something like that. But
we didn't.
This is The Store Before the Wall. So I did write this kind of fantastic short piece that I haven't published yet because I probably need to work a little harder to get it out because I'm really terrible about submitting things. Anyway, so there were cassia seeds in that book. I remember that. In that short story, it was about an old lady who was like 600 years old, she'd been behind that store since before the wall began, before it started. So yeah, is that a Kafka influence? Probably. It's kind of like, the way, kinds of stuff we look for. And yeah, it was a fun little story, but I don't think it ended up in the novel in any concrete way. But I think, the exercise of the mind, that calisthenics we do every time we write, whether a story that's published or not, is always good for you. So it probably got in there somehow.
Yeah, I wrote my story, but I don't think I think I left it. I bought this really cool notepad when I was in Beijing. You were talking about how you can buy these really cool notepads.
Yeah.
I bought one and I wrote it in there, the first draft in there. I still have the notepad, and I should go in and look at the story because I don't even remember anything about it except that the wall in the story wasn't the wall of China. It was the wall separating Ciudad Juarez from El Paso, Texas, where I live. That's all I remember about it.
Yeah, cool. Well, yeah, I hope you can find it.
Yeah. Well, if I'm compelled to go back to it, definitely. Ted O'Connell, congratulations on K, a novel. Can you tell us what you're working on next? What's the next book that you're going to publish?
Well, I did start a novel this summer. That's exciting, and it's called. And right now, I'm calling it 99 Balloons. And yes, that is a reference to the German band Nina.
Oh, I remember that song.
Yeah. I love that song. I'm a sucker for that song.
Yeah, me too.
And the weird thing is, just to tell you real quick, that the basic plot of this book is that Trump gets reelected, and this young woman who's living near Billings, Montana, who's a musician, finds a dead hiker who is a German national, and she steals her passport. And it's like, I'm going to get out of here. I got to go. I'm leaving the country. So that's the kind of... that's the big picture sweeping,
nice
story plot. Yeah. So she goes, she finds a way to get to Germany. But the funny thing is, like, since, the events of January 6th, I don't know that I have to figure out what to do about that because I'm happy to rewrite history to a point. Imagine that Trump got reelected and imagine what that means. But, I'm definitely struggling now with, like, I don't know if I can rewrite that history. That thing happened, So I think, as a writer, a lot of writing is just problem solving. I don't know if that makes it seem less romantic than it is, but that's a problem I have to deal with. But I have faith that in that problem solving, something, perhaps even more interesting will come from that. But it's a nagging feeling like, oh crap, what am I going to do with this?
Well, maybe, when they storm the Capitol, it becomes a heroic act in the eyes of, the alternate media, and that alternate media becomes the more dominant, voice in American media. And so it's actually, those people are remembered as patriots, I can't also help but think of Philip Roth, The Case Against America. I don't know if you've re-entered that novel before, but...
No, I haven't. I've read about three of his books, and I love him. I mean, he's really, really good. So I have not read that. I should check it out.
Oh, it's worthwhile because it's what would happen if Lindbergh had become president. And as you know, Lindbergh was, fascist.
Anti-Semitic.
And so it's really a wonderful... And also, I can't also think of... Philip K. Dick, I think his name is, the one who wrote that novel, Man in the Iron Tower, which is about what would have happened in the U.S. if the Japanese and the Germans had won the war. What would America be like?
Yeah, wow, cool. Those are heavy hitters. I wonder if I can hang.
I would read that.
My daughter was just talking about Philip K. Dick last night or yesterday in the car. Yeah.
The Man in Hightower, that's what it's called. It's also a series now. I would read that, Ted. I would love to imagine that world, but only imagine it.
Yeah, it's really more like it's more a backdrop. It's much more ultimately about this young woman's relationship with her mother and her family, her parents. Because the other thing she gets caught up in, because this is a very American book, is her parents cheat on her, cheat for her to try to get her into college. So she feels very betrayed by that. Mm-hmm. So she feels betrayed by her country, betrayed by that. And so she's like, screw you, I'm going to go find a new family in Germany.
Wow. It sounds like it's going to be great.
So I got to go to Germany next summer. I got an excuse to travel if I can get my shot.
Oh, and I'll meet you there, man. We'll hang out together and eat some good food and drink some nice Marzen.
And then we'll go to the another wall, the Berlin Wall, and say, let's each write a story about the wall, and then one of us will lose it.
That's it. We got to do it. All right, Ted, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. I wish you the best of luck on that novel that you're working on. And everybody listening, please read Kay. It's an amazing journey. And thank you for joining us.